This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, more than 12 million U.S. workers stand to benefit from new Labor Department rules on overtime pay if the GOP doesn't block them first. A new round of immigration raids begins, targeting, among others, Central Americans who have arrived since 2014. And Greek activists occupy an abandoned hotel in Athens to shelter refugees stranded by sealed borders. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Millions of U.S. workers should see a spike in their paycheck or be scheduled for fewer unpaid hours by year's end. The Department of Labor announced new overtime rules this week, and according to the Economic Policy Institute, many of the more than 12 million middle-class salaried workers who stand to benefit are women, people of color, or workers without advanced degrees. Most people are under the impression that only hourly workers qualify for overtime pay, but that's not exactly right. Some salaried employees also qualify, but only if they make less than $23,660 a year. That's the equivalent of $455 per week, or $11.37 an hour. Simply put, these are workers who often put in 50, 60, even 70 hours, but get paid for 40. Under the new rules, that salary threshold is nearly doubled, making millions more workers eligible for overtime pay.
There's $12 billion more dollars over the next 10 years will go into the economy to people who will spend it all,
In announcing the new rule Tuesday, Vice President Joe Biden also predicted a boost to the economy.
But this means there are going to be more people working at the soda fountain, more people at the movie theater, more people at the beauty salon. It means people are going to go spend this money. Because let me tell you something. If you're making $25,000, $35,000 a year, you don't have any disposable income after you meet your basic needs. So all this goes back in the economy.
Ahead of the announcement, a coalition of business groups appealed to Congress, urging lawmakers to block the move. They say workers will lose benefits that go along with their salaried positions, like flex time and health care. The GOP reaction was swift, with vows to prevent the new rules from taking effect December 1st, just weeks before President Obama leaves office. The French Parliament has extended emergency powers in the country until the end of July. With two major sporting events on the horizon, lawmakers easily passed the extension, but did drop the warrantless raid provision from the powers put in place following the November terror attacks in Paris. The vote came just hours after an Egypt Air flight en route from Paris to Cairo crashed over the Mediterranean with 66 people on board. The cause is not yet known. Officials used the now extended emergency powers to preemptively arrest protest organizers ahead of widespread and ongoing demonstrations. Rallies against a controversial labor reform grew this week after the president invoked a different emergency power, allowing him to sidestep Parliament and implement the measure. Lawmakers had been widely expected to reject the bill that critics say weakens worker protections. Tensions between protesters and police escalated when officers counter-protested in what many saw as provocation. From Paris, Raphael Kraft reports.
Cette loi, elle va passer.
This law will be adopted, and I will not give up like so many did before me, French President François Hollande said on French private radio Europe 1, referring to the labor law his government pushed through last week, using an obscure provision of the French Constitution known as Article 49.3. Just a few hours later, tens of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets, marching in many of France's main cities. According to opponents, the law will weaken labor protections, making it easier for employers to fire workers. Sébastien, a 30-year-old private telephone company employee, chose not to give his last name.
I am here to express my anger against this law, against all they do, especially against 49.3. I didn't think France could be a dictatorship. That's why I'm here.
Although polls say a majority of French people are against this proposed reform, observers believe the government is expecting the movement to run out of steam. Trade unions are divided on the best strategy to adopt, and the strikes they called in public transport, including France's ports, trains and airports, have not been broad enough to make any real impact nationwide. Raphael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN's Spring Fund Drive, visit our website, fsrn.org. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson began a two-day visit to El Salvador and Honduras Thursday. His trip comes as U.S. immigration authorities, under his mandate, kicked off another round of deportation raids. Among those targeted for removal, Central American families who have arrived since the start of 2014. The Obama administration calls the raids part of a security strategy aimed at deterring another surge of Central American women and children along the southern border. But immigration rights advocates say authorities are deliberately refusing to recognize a refugee crisis at the nation's doorstep. Shannon Young has more.
Few things send waves of fear through immigrant communities like deportation raids. So when Reuters reported last Thursday that a new round of raids was in the works, it immediately grabbed the attention of immigrant advocacy organizations. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security have offered little in the way of details, but White House spokesperson Josh Earnest confirmed the plans in a briefing last Friday.
The operations that are underway are merely the continuation of operations that were announced in January and in March. And those operations are conducted under the rubric of the guidance that President Obama and Secretary Johnson put in place in November of 2014. And that is guidance that made a priority of individuals who are convicted criminals or otherwise a threat to public safety, or individuals who were apprehended after crossing the border after January 1st of 2014.
The latter category includes a significant influx of Central American women and children who applied for but did not obtain asylum status.
The administration is telling us that they're only focusing on children and families with final orders and that they have had an opportunity to request this protection. However, what's been very clear from the last round of raids is that this is not consistently the case.
Michelle Brenet is the director of the Migrant Rights and Justice Program at the Women's Refugee Commission. She says that due process is generally lacking in the asylum proceedings in which women and children often have to make their claims in an unfamiliar system without the help of an attorney.
According to government-obtained statistics, only about 30% of the women who are here with children, who've arrived with children, are represented at any point throughout their proceedings. And under 50% of the unaccompanied children have had representation. And representation makes an enormous difference in the success rate of a protection claim. We know that, in fact, that somebody who is represented is 14 times more likely to win their claim than somebody who does not have representation.
The immigration court system does not provide public defenders for those who can't afford legal representation, leading advocates to compare the asylum claim process to traffic court rules with death penalty consequences. When the numbers of Central American women and children arriving on the southern border increased dramatically in 2014, the Obama administration implemented a number of policies purportedly aimed at deterrence. These included returning to the controversial practice of detaining women and children in for-profit detention centers for months at a time. Two such facilities opened in South Texas for just that purpose. The administration also began media campaigns in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, sending a message that U.S. borders were not open. Yet the families keep coming. Dr. Jonathan T. Hiske, an associate professor of political science at Vanderbilt University, authored a recent study on the Central American refugee crisis. He says surveys conducted in El Salvador and Honduras show that people who flee the region are aware of the risks, but other push factors outweigh the U.S. deterrence campaign.
First, we have strong evidence that this U.S. send a message campaign, if you will, has been heard loud and clear in terms of convincing Central Americans that the risks of migration to the U.S. have never been higher and the chances of success have never been lower. Our second main finding, however, is that for these same survey respondents, knowledge of the increased risk of migrating to the U.S. and the increased risk of deportation has no impact whatsoever on their decision to migrate. Rather, the overwhelming predictor of someone in El Salvador or Honduras expressing a desire to immigrate is whether or not that person has been victimized by crime multiple times in the previous year.
In January of this year, Secretary of State John Kerry announced a new initiative that would screen Central American asylum applicants in their countries of origin. But according to Joanne Kelsey of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, this new program has yet to benefit a single person with legal entry into the United States. Immigrant and refugee advocacy groups are calling on the Obama administration to start treating Central American women and children who pass the government's own credible fear test as refugees rather than economic migrants or national security threats. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
About 54,000 refugees remain stranded in Greece, trapped between the sealed borders of the Balkan route and a perilous sea journey they made before the controversial EU-Turkey detention and deportation deal. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Migrants visited the country this week and called for Greece to stop detaining migrant children, some of whom he said were locked in cells for weeks on end. While many children languish in detention, most migrants in the country are homeless or living in poor conditions. Now, some Greek activists are using civil disobedience to address the humanitarian crisis that the state is unable to handle. Andrew Connolly reports from Athens.
The spirit of political resistance, so pervasive in the streets of Greece, has spread into the reception of a long-abandoned hotel in downtown Athens. Radical Greek activists have occupied the seven-story building and transformed it into a cooperative sanctuary for hundreds of refugee families. The border closures of Greece's northern neighbors, from Macedonia to Austria, have trapped over 54,000 refugees in Greece, many of them homeless or living in squalid camps scattered the length and breadth of the country. On an afternoon in May, the dining room of what was once a privately operated three-star hotel, known as the City Plaza, is a cacophony of Greek, English, Arabic, and Farsi as the daily assembly is held. Lukia, one of the Greek activists behind the occupation, explains their motivation.
So the concept is to build new communities, to build new communities of coexistence between refugees and the local population. What is at the same time very urgent is to start to work with the idea and the reality that we are going to live together, because thousands of people were captured in Greece. They didn't want to stay in Greece. They wanted to, you know, a lot of women here are waiting to go to Germany or to other countries where their husbands are already there.
The UNHCR estimates that over 60% of Greece's trapped refugees are women and children. The occupied City Plaza Hotel offers them a respite, including for those that have decided to leave the makeshift camps near the sealed borders. In April, in the border town of Idomeni, FSRN met Nezrin, an English teacher from Aleppo. She's now in the Athens hotel, making a coffee with one hand, while balancing her two-year-old son, Basel, with the other.
Or the women think that if my husband will be in Germany, so about 1 month, 2 months, 5 months maximum, I will be with him. But now it's about 1 year without anything. So I decided to go
to see to this place by boat alone with my son, just to reach my husband. I want to be with my family. Yeah, well, it's I don't know. I cannot hold alone all this trouble things.
Nazreen's husband, Zaher, fled Syria to Dortmund last year to find work with the hope that family reunification laws would be able to swiftly and safely bring his wife and son across. Nazreen waited a year in Turkey. But as Germany struggled under the sheer weight of asylum claims, she decided to make the journey with her son. The limbo is hard, but Nazreen appreciates the effort of the City Plaza activists.
They are good people. Yeah, they are nice people. Maybe because they are poor like us. They don't have that ideology thinking about material and money. And they know about war because they lived a long time like the days that we live.
One of the hotel activists, journalist Yanis Androulidakis, has a deeper connection to his guests than most. His father was a Greek refugee from Turkey who subsequently fled to France to escape oppression under the military dictatorship of the 60s. Androulidakis emphasizes the importance of sharing the duties of the hotel with the refugees and helping them integrate into Greece, their unexpected new home.
Our plan is to make places, to create places in the middle of the cities where the refugees can live, so in order to be part of our society. Maybe not today, but live in dignity, have food and somewhere to sleep, and then begin to fight for the rights and be part of our society just like us.
The City Plaza is also a metaphor for Greece's ailing fortunes. Built before the 2004 Olympics, with loans freely given out in the boom years, the business folded shortly after as the country began its descent into chronic economic depression. The activists claim the boss withheld the employee's salary, but Androulidakis says the former workers are on their side and support the hotel's new role in alleviating the humanitarian crisis.
Maybe 100 hotels opened before the Olympic Games, take the money and run. So now we have 100 empty hotels in the center of Athens, and in the same time, 50,000 people who live in the streets.
Although an illegal occupation, for now the authorities have left City Plaza alone, no doubt grateful that it's a few hundred less refugees for them to worry about. As the evening draws in, an American blues musician plays for children from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and beyond. Thousands of refugees remain homeless in Greece, many of them locked up in detention centers on the Greek islands. But tonight, the City Plaza will shelter 400 guests, and in doing so, providing a glimpse of an alternative approach to housing asylum seekers, far removed from segregation and incarceration. Andrew Connolly, FSRN, Athens.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. Researchers say suicide rates in Gaza are soaring to unprecedented highs as the humanitarian situation on the ground there in the impoverished and blockaded coastal territory deteriorates over time. Abir Ayub reports from Gaza City.
Suicide was once a very rare cause of death in the very conservative society in Gaza. Yet since the second half of 2015, researchers started noticing a sharp increase in the suicide rate in the besieged enclave. Dr. Rami Abdo of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor says hunger and depression have driven young people in Gaza to commit suicide in public acts, such as setting themselves on fire or throwing themselves from tall structures.
We've documented 5 cases of people who died by committing suicide in the first 3 months of this year. These are the cases we know about, which means there are more cases we don't know about. If we compare this number with previous years, we can see there's been a spike. The number of people who committed suicide in the first quarter of this year is equal to the number of those who died by suicide in all of last year.
The same organization's figures say at least 90 others tried to kill themselves since the beginning of 2016, but survived their attempts. Experts suggest many of these cases were more cries for help than earnest attempts to die, but that they should be taken seriously. Rizq Abu Sitta is one of those who survived. The father of seven climbed an antenna tower in downtown Gaza City in February and threatened to jump off it.
I had nothing to lose. I wanted to escape. When civil defense employees showed up, they all spoke from their own perspective, saying things like, "Come down, this is prohibited." Do they think I don't know it's prohibited? I was just leaving the mosque after the afternoon prayer. I walked for a bit. I didn't know where to go. I was feeling under so much pressure, and I climbed.
Abu Sitta, who is an employee of the Palestinian Authority, said he felt desperate about how the seemingly endless fighting between the governments of Gaza and the West Bank was blocking his salary payments and making it impossible to provide for his family. It's a familiar situation for many Palestinian civil servants in Gaza.
People have reached a point at which they can see there is no horizon, no future, no open borders, no aspirations. People graduate from schools and then stand in lines waiting for a job. The situation in Gaza gets worse every day.
The 2014 Israeli offensive in the Gaza Strip left widespread destruction to residential areas, and while nearly 3,000 homes have been rebuilt, about 75,000 people are still internally displaced, living in shelters or camping out with family. The unemployment rate in Gaza is 44%, one of the highest in the world, and nearly 38% of families here live below the poverty line. According to Gaza-based psychiatrist Fadel Ashour, the situation in Gaza is obviously affecting people, and the suicide rate increasing is a result.
These young people don't have jobs, so they can't get married and live a stable life and move out. They're denied everything that young people need.
With more than 1.8 million people living in the tiny coastal enclave, cut off from the rest of the world by an economic blockade and travel restrictions, the overall sense of hopelessness at the unique social and political situation in Gaza is driving the suicide rate up. Again, Dr. Rami Abdu.
After the latest Israeli offensive, many people thought that the situation in Gaza would improve because the international community would intervene and the borders would reopen, bringing back freedom of movement between Gaza residents and the outside world. This didn't happen.
And with the United Nations predicting that Gaza could be uninhabitable by 2020, that's not likely to change. Abir Ayoub, FSRN, Gaza.
Since the end of the 90s, sales of prescription opioids have nearly quadrupled in the United States. And according to the Centers for Disease Control, overdose deaths have increased at a similar pace. Opioids are close chemical cousins of heroin and include Vicodin, OxyContin, codeine, morphine, and Percocet. Attention to opioid misuse and abuse was on the rise well before the recent death of music icon Prince, and speculation continues about the role prescription painkillers may have played in his death. But one thing is sure, there is strong bipartisan support for legislation reining in opioid use and calls for doctors to think twice before prescribing the painkillers. FSRN's Lina Nozizwe reports from Los Angeles that new guidelines could have a major effect on older patients.
Around one-third of Americans from their late 40s to their late 80s deal with some sort of chronic pain, according to the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. 52-year-old Martha is one of them. She has plantar fasciitis, an inflammatory condition that makes it painful to stand, even though she has to be on her feet during her shifts at a Los Angeles grocery store. When she's been admitted to the hospital, doctors routinely prescribe opioid painkillers, even though she says taking the drug could be dangerous for her.
So, and they have this on file, and I always have to tell them, I have a heart condition, how am I going to take this? And if it says, you know, it can harm you, and they still give it to me.
A Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study found that healthcare providers wrote 259 million prescriptions for opioid medications in 2012. That's enough for every adult living in the United States to have a bottle of pills. And while seniors report more chronic pain symptoms than other age groups, treating their pain with opioids comes with a greater number of risks. Dr. James Edwards, who's been practicing medicine for more than 30 years, says doctors should factor the patient's age, condition, and use of other medications into the decision to prescribe opioids.
As people get older, they may be more susceptible to side effects and so forth, and so you may want to alter your decision whether to use a medicine at all, or if you use it, perhaps the dosing of the medicine.
The CDC reports that 44 Americans die every day because of prescription drug overdoses, with the majority of those deaths involving prescription opioids. Those overdoses include instances in which patients followed instructions given by doctors who were prescribed the wrong opioid medication or just too much of it. During his most recent weekly address, President Obama shared some of the sobering statistics that have made the issue a priority.
Now, drug overdoses now take more lives every year than traffic accidents. Deaths from opioid overdoses have tripled since 2000. A lot of time, they're from legal drugs prescribed by a doctor.
Just last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed 18 opioid-related bills with strong bipartisan support. During a news conference before the votes, House Speaker Paul Ryan said the proposed laws call for a broad range of measures.
Many states have taken action, but this threat also requires a national response. So whether it is protecting infants, whether it is stopping kingpins or pushers, or making better use of data, we are going to take all of these ideas, pass them through the House, go into a conference committee with the Senate, and we intend to put a bill on the president's desk fast.
But funding for the program outlined in the legislation is less clear. The White House is seeking more than $1 billion for treatment, monitoring, and enforcement. Opioid prescriptions were less common before the late 1990s, with the Drug Enforcement Administration closely monitoring legal sales of the drugs and the doctors authorized to prescribe them. Veteran physician James Edwards says the painkiller pendulum then swung in the other direction, with a campaign calling on doctors to treat pain symptoms with more potent medication.
I remember, as many physicians, 15 years ago or so, there was a huge push to monitor everybody on, are they checking for patients' pain, and are they treating this? My impression, and from what I've read also, is that part of this whole effect of all that was that people increased their treatment use of pain with opioids.
Dr. Edwards says for him, it has always been a matter of balancing the risks and the benefits in individual cases. He does not know how legislation, existing and proposed, will impact the trends in opioid use for patients of all ages. But with an opioid epidemic reaching crisis proportions and creating pressure on politicians to act, legislation may soon force the hand of doctor discretion. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that does it for this week's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by The Artisans Beats via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.